Welcome back everyone to another episode of The Damage Report. I'm John Adirola. Big show today, starting with some drama brewing in the Democratic caucus in the House and then proceeding into sort of weird territory. We've got an interesting endorsement strategy from Bernie Sanders, who's stressing the people who don't want him to be president more than those who do in a very interesting way. We're gonna be breaking those down, giving you some examples. We have another high profile Republican, this time a candidate, making the case that he cannot be alone with women who are not his wife, which in some cases is a personal choice. In this case, it's impacting someone's career. And then we're gonna end with Ben Shapiro's new war against women's soccer. I mean, if anyone has justified critiques of sports performance, it would of course be Ben Shapiro. He doesn't like Megan Rapinoe, he doesn't like her political activism. There's an interesting twist on that, by the way. We've got a poll we're gonna show you in that last block, fascinating information about Megan Rapinoe. So we'll see, some stuff that I don't think Ben Shapiro would be a big fan of. Along the way, you know when you do your taxes, there's a little check off to donate some money to the presidential, like the people's funded presidential campaign fund. Who is actually clicking that? Who's actually signing off on that? Both amongst regular population, also those running for the president. Very interesting information, I guess, gonna be joining us to break down a little bit later on. But we start off here in the US with Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi does not want people in the Democratic caucus, in the House, criticizing each other. And she is going to deliver that message by criticizing members of her own caucus. She says, this is from, by the way, from the Washington Post. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi admonished Democrats for personally attacking one another, warning in a closed door meeting Wednesday that the party's fracturing was jeopardizing its majority. Without naming names, her target was clear, the four liberal freshmen known as the squad. So this is updating reporting, an update from Wednesday on something we've been talking about throughout the week, which is her attacking mainly AOC, but not just AOC, for some of their recent comments. In particular, recently there was the back and forth over the funding bill for the concentration camps. But previously, I mean, if you go back month by month, Nancy Pelosi has had, you know, long periods of attacking Ilhan Omar, playing into the right wing argument that she's anti-Semitic and all of that. At one point attacking AOC, saying that in districts like hers, a glass of water could win on the Democratic ticket. So it doesn't actually mean anything that she had this historic win and became the youngest person ever to serve in the House of Representatives. Doesn't mean nothing at all. She referred to the Green Dream or whatever, I think she said. And so she has frequently attacked these individuals, but now let's not critique each other. And she said this, you got a complaint, you come and talk to me about it. But do not tweet about our members and expect us to think that it is just okay. Don't tweet about our members. That is inappropriate. What you are supposed to do is go to your contacts, the New York Times, Washington Post, stuff like that, and then give them exclusive quotes where you attack those people. Don't tweet about it. That's free. Anybody can do that. You need access to criticize each other. And so look, we've been talking about this story and Pelosi is not backing down. She defended those comments on Wednesday saying, I have no regrets about anything. Regrets is not what I do. That in particular about the comments that the four, the squad, who voted against that funding bill for the concentration camps, it's just four votes. They don't have much power. And again, this is in her campaign to say, let's not criticize each other. She says, oh, that critique that I said, attacking them as irrelevant and pointless. Yeah, I stand by that. So a little bit of mixed messaging coming from the speaker right here. But understand, she's gotta fill her time somehow. She's not pushing for impeachment. She's not really pushing for much of anything. What is she gonna do if not attack the newest, most dynamic members of her own caucus? And so they're not just going to stand by and allow her to continually attack them without saying anything. They're gonna push back respectfully, but they do push back, starting with AOC, who said, when these comments first started, I kind of thought that she was keeping the progressive flank at more of an arm's distance in order to protect more moderate members, which I understood. But the persistent singling out, it got to a point where it was just outright disrespectful. The explicit singling out of newly elected women of color. And so there she's pointing out both that this is not just a new thing, this is not 2 weeks of Nancy Pelosi attacking these members of her caucus. This goes back to, I mean, before they were elected, but certainly last November, pointing out that sure, they won some stuff, but this is really a story of moderates. This is a story of centrists. Yeah, they're getting a lot of, you know, press coverage and sure, millions of people are signing on to follow them on social media, but it doesn't mean anything. The attack started very early on. And it is interesting, of course, that Nancy Pelosi is targeting Ayanna Pressley, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, AOC. I mean, this is not like she's just going after white males or anything like that. No, I don't necessarily know that that is what is primarily animating Nancy Pelosi. I imagine that The fact that they are willing to stand up to her is probably a bigger part. The fact that ideologically they're opposed to her, even though she says she agrees with them on those issues, and in fact tries to make the case that she is a stronger proponent for things like single payer healthcare, the environment, carbon taxes, all of that. I think ideologically that's what's really driving her, but it is not lost on these individuals that once again, the most vociferous action that she's taking is against young women of color. And so it's not just her, of course, you also have Ayanna Pressley who's been attacked recently. She said, "Thank God my mother gave me broad shoulders and a strong back. I can handle it, I'm not worried about me." Though she did call Pelosi's comments demoralizing. She said, "I am worried about the signal that it sends to people I speak to and for who sent me here with a mandate and how it affects them." And that makes all the sense in the world. I mean, Nancy Pelosi has explicitly said, those districts anybody could win. It doesn't mean anything that these people were chosen. But go to those districts and talk to the people who worked for them. Talk to the volunteers, talk to the people who, in AOC's case, for instance, who overthrew one of the most powerful Democrats. To say to them, it doesn't mean anything, anybody could have won. How is that anything but demoralizing? And the same thing could be said in these other races as well. It means something that they were elected. To say that Ilhan Omar getting elected to the House of Representatives doesn't mean anything. Anybody could have been elected. I mean, we would attack Donald Trump if he said that. We would attack Trump Jr. We would attack any Republican if they so aggressively, optionally, purposefully disrespected these individuals, we would attack them. And so we're not going to pull our punches just because it's Nancy Pelosi. If she thinks that she has some kind of immunity, either because she's the leader of the House Dems, because she's been around for a long time, no, there's no immunity whatsoever. We should attack her more forcefully because our standards should be that much higher for her. Now let's move to some more of the response. AOC saying, "The third and fourth time she insulted me, it was like, this is unnecessary, but I'm not going to pick a fight over it. Whatever, I'll be the punching bag if that's what they want me to be. But now people are telling the freshman to talk to Pelosi. She doesn't want to, however." AOC said, there hasn't really been a relationship, to be frank. It's difficult. So look at that. You have, at the time, perhaps still a 29-year-old member of the House of Representatives saying, "Look, if this woman who's been in the House for literally ever, if she needs me to be the punching bag, I will do that. At the same time that I'm the one driving national conversations about our immigration policy, our response to the climate breakdown, all of that, I will also allow myself to be the punching bag for our House leadership, if that's what is what required. If there's such children that they need someone like me to punch to seem strong and in charge, I'll do that." That's what she says. And yet, she tries through all of that to establish a relationship. This is being pitched in the media, and mostly by people who are trying to use it for their own purposes, like Fox News and stuff like that, to say that this is a feud, that they're both being unfair, they're both being catty. That's what Kellyanne Conway said. This is a cat fight between Pelosi and AOC. But it is anything but, because a cat fight requires two people to be sort of unfair or emotional or whatever. That's the vicious misogynistic stereotype. But here you have AOC who's not only being responsible in all aspects of her career, but at the same time constantly extending a hand to try to have a relationship with Nancy Pelosi, a person who seems dead set on not understanding what AOC is about or why she was elected, what it says about the country, what it says about the Democratic Party, where it's going and where it should go. Nancy Pelosi does not want to understand that, and so she has rebuffed the advances of AOC in all cases. Now, we do have a little bit of update as of this morning on the prior comment. So we talked about AOC saying that she had been singling out newly elected women of color. So she was asked to follow up about that by Manu Raju, who tweeted, "Just asked AOC if she stands by her comment that Pelosi singles out women of color." AOC responded, "Well, I think it's really just pointing out a pattern, right? We're not talking just about progressives, it's singling out four individuals and knowing the media environment we're operating in. Knowing the amount of death threats we get, knowing the amount of concentration of attention, I think it's worth asking why." And that's true. I mean, look, these four individuals, I think rightfully, like I just said, they drive a lot of the political conversation that we've had over the past 6 months or so. But it's not like they're the only progressives in the House or in government. The Congressional Progressive Caucus has a lot of other members. I mean, Ro Khanna is awesome. How often does Nancy Pelosi throw him under the bus? I mean, he occasionally commits the sin of working with Republicans on things like getting us out of the disastrous war in Yemen. Yet she's not bothered by that. I mean, he's pushing for the same policies that AOC and Ilhan Omar and Ayanna Pressley and all the rest are pushing for. And yet she's not going after Ro Khanna. There does seem to be something about these four women. I don't know exactly what it is. I don't know if it's a racial thing. I don't know if it's a gender thing. I don't know if it's a fact that they stood most forcefully up to her before she became Speaker of the House, especially with Ayanna Pressley saying as soon as she was elected that she wouldn't necessarily support Nancy Pelosi. Maybe it's just a personal thing where it's like, how dare you go against me? How dare you endanger my leadership of the party? Or perhaps it's the fact that, I mean, they're getting all this attention. They're getting people to follow what they're saying and doing. And Nancy Pelosi, who says that she has the strategy, she knows what needs to happen. Maybe she's not as confident inside. Maybe she gets that this strategy of not standing up to Donald Trump, not pushing on impeachment, and now effectively locking herself into a position where if there's any criticism of Donald Trump that gets too strong, she needs to push back against that because that makes the case in of itself for impeachment. She effectively has become a bit of a de facto defender of Donald Trump. She has to be because she has said for the next year and a half, we cannot impeach, we can't talk about impeachment, it will doom us. And so anything that would lead to that conversation, she needs to push back against. That's the road that she has chosen for herself. These four women, they have chosen a different road. And possibly she's looking at that and thinking, man, I really wish I could be that. You know, I came into government with these big plans and I love to talk about how if you go into my basement, you're gonna find signs about single payer. But now where are the signs? You know, if she were to hold a sign today, what would it say? It would say protect Donald Trump, honestly, because that's the role that she fills. There's no positive agenda that's being pushed. The only agenda seems to be attempting to hamstring those who are actually drawing some positive press coverage of the Democrats in the House. And it's possible this will continue. I can't see it working in Nancy Pelosi's favor long term, but so far it's been month after month with her picking fights and she seems to choose. Maybe it'll be Tlaib this week. Maybe it's Ilhan Omar. Oh my God, right wingers are mad at one of my members. I better pile on her as well. Or maybe it'll be her favorite punching bag, AOC. We'll see. The war so far does not seem to be going her way, and those women seem to be only gaining in power. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, lots more to get to.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
You've probably been filling out your taxes and you've come to the point where they have the little box that you can check to donate $3 to the public financing system for our presidents. And you've probably checked it from time to time. I know I have. But what about the people actually running in that system, especially those who are running for president and have talked about financing publicly for those sorts of campaigns in the past? Are they actually clicking it? Very interesting topic. And joining us now to break it down, Jeff West, writer for The Fulcrum. Welcome to The Damage Report.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. So I'm going to be honest, while you know I've donated the fund before and I've certainly noticed it when doing my taxes, I haven't thought too often about what percentage of the American public is taking part, and especially those who are going to be running for president. So you've done an investigation, and what have you found?
Well, so in the general public, about 6% check the box. So the fact that you check the box is unique. But among the presidential candidates, about half of those who have released their tax returns show that they have checked the box to designate money to the public financing system that exists. Not all candidates have released their tax returns. About half of them haven't. Most of those are low polling candidates. Interestingly enough, the top polling candidate, Joe Biden, has checked it on every tax return that he's released, going back to going back 15 years or more. So.
So it looks like he's been the most constant in contributing to the fund. He's also, I believe, the only one who's actually drawn funds from that fund. Correct? He actually in one of his runs was a beneficiary of it.
That's correct. That's correct. About $2 million back when the fund was more active as far as helping presidential candidates. These days, you can raise a lot more money without the public financing system, which requires you to not take direct donations from people. So you can raise a lot more money through individual contributions from people than you can through the public financing system. So it's in the last few elections, it's become sort of mute, but you know, in the 2000s, it was relevant, and the tax returns released by the a lot of the candidates show that they didn't always contribute to this public financing system, even though they pretty much all support the idea of public financing. So today,
while we're on the topic, I'm interested. How much money per year does this fund bring in? And also, right now, when you check it, it's a $3 contribution. Has it been a $3 contribution going back to the beginning, or has that been adjusted over time?
Originally it was a $1 contribution. Interestingly enough, Congress was worried that the fund would dry up because so many people were using it. And this was in the late 70s that they increased it to $3. And that's where it currently stands now. There is over a few hundred million dollars worth of funds sort of sitting there. The question is what do you do with it? Because nobody's using it. None of the major party candidates are actually drawing money from the fund at this point.
Well, my initial answer will be apparently there's money sitting around. I was considering running anyway. I guess I'll just do it. I probably couldn't raise that much privately, so I might as well I've contributed to it. Why not?
Sure.
While we're on the subject of those who have and who have not contributed to the fund, in this case, Donald Trump actually has, you found evidence of.
Yeah, that was an interesting find. The one tax return that we have that shows whether or not he did check the box or didn't. He did, and this was in 2005. He checked the box to designate $3 to the presidential campaign fund. There's also a program in New Jersey on his New Jersey tax return. He didn't check the box, so there's that. But on the one tax return that we do have for him, he did. So that was interesting because the same year you had, you know, Kamala Harris not check the box, and a few other candidates. I should say that Elizabeth Warren checked the box every year going back 10 years, and Bernie Sanders. I believe it was four out of 10 years.
Four out of 10.
Is what he, yeah.
So I'm curious. 10. I mean, you've been talking about how the fund has continued, but the usage of it has changed over time. In terms of possible reforms for it, so it looks like 7 senators currently campaigning for the White House have co-sponsored a bill to allow for individual donations and public financing. Is that sort of reform, is that possibly something that could pass?
Well, it certainly has the support of the Democratic Party, Democrats in the House and Democrats in the Senate, with the companion bills that essentially do the same thing to expand and public financing. It has no chance of passing as far as long as the Republican Senate, or as long as the Senate is controlled by a Republican majority, specifically Mitch McConnell, who has said he's not going to bring it up for debate.
Okay, well, so, unfortunately, that seems like the story of our time. Jeff West, we appreciate you joining us and breaking this down, your research into the area. Thank you for joining us on the show.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, Bernie Sanders with a new webpage highlighting those who have not endorsed him for president. Very interesting stuff. We'll show you after this. If you go to pretty much any political candidate's website, you're going to find the section that has the endorsements, the individuals and the groups who have said, this guy or girl is good, you should vote for them. But Bernie Sanders is going in a different direction. He quoted FDR by saying, I ask you to judge me by the enemies I have made. And so to that end, he has made a section of anti-endorsements where he's listed individuals who have spoken out against him, sometimes uniquely against him. They'll accept any other Democratic candidate except Bernie Sanders. He's listed what they've said and also why you might not necessarily want to agree with these individuals. So we're going to go through a few of them, although you should definitely go to the website and see more. First, you have Haim Saban. So this is a billionaire. You're going to notice that a lot of them are billionaires. But he spent millions of dollars contributing to candidates and effectively, you know, buying their support. He's also in the past called for the bombing of Iran in 2014, attacked President Obama's attempts to bring peace to the Middle East, and attacked senators for urging humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip. And he said on the candidates, we love all 23 candidates. No, minus one. I profoundly dislike Bernie Sanders. He thinks that every billionaire is a crook. He calls us the billionaire class and he attacks us indiscriminately. Well, can you imagine being a billionaire and someone refers to you as the billionaire class? That would put a real itch in your britches. But anyway, so he likes everybody except Bernie Sanders. Now, for the most part, the billionaires that we're gonna highlight are attacking Bernie Sanders because of his economic philosophy. And for some of them, they would probably oppose other candidates who agree with Bernie on some of the policies too. In this particular case, it mainly seems to be a foreign policy thing. And in particular, the US policy towards Israel. He disagrees with Bernie Sanders on that. So Haim Saban, anti-endorsement highlighted on Bernie Sanders' page. Now we get into other billionaires generally who are opposed to him on things like taxes, minimum wage, and things like that. You have Kenneth Langone, co-founder of Home Depot. One of the things, the through lines in these endorsements I've noticed is that everyone involved in creating Home Depot is apparently a hardcore right winger. That's apparently what I'm seeing. But Kenneth Langone, he's a net worth of $3.7 billion. Despite that, Home Depot's wages are so low that many of their workers, like at places like Walmart and stuff like that, are on food stamps, Medicaid, public housing, effectively being subsidized by US taxpayers, which means that Kenneth Langone's wages effectively are being subsidized by US taxpayers. Now he has previously said in 2016, I saw Bernie Sanders and the kids around him. I thought this is the Antichrist. Why? Because he looks at that $9 minimum wage and says, I want it to be higher. I want it to be 10, I want it to be 12, I want it to be maybe 15. I want these people to be able to afford to live in America. And for that, Antichrist. But not just Bernie Sanders, the people who support him as well. So Kenneth Langone, hardcore anti-endorsement there. You have billionaires like Andy Puzder saying all these proposals, Sanders proposals, they're just going to kill the growth. I mean, this is a guy who has gotten rich, fat, and happy off of the policies of people like, you know, Trump and George Bush, but also Obama and you know, Bill Clinton too. And the fact that minimum wage has been kept so low, you know, things like protections, like the access of unions to collective bargaining, overtime rules, all of those things have been effectively kept in a way that denies the full access and participation in the economy to the American workers. That's a thing that's worked for him. And so I sort of get it. I get why he wouldn't like Bernie Sanders, but I also get why a lot of people might be interested in the fact that this guy doesn't like Bernie Sanders and might want to learn a little bit more about Sanders' agenda. Lloyd Blankfein, former CEO of Goldman Sachs, turns out not a big Sanders supporter, saying on Bernie's candidacy, it has the potential to be a dangerous moment. Now look at that. Lloyd Blankfein says that Bernie Sanders' run is a dangerous moment. This is a guy who benefited massively from the Great Recession. Huge bailout from the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department. You know, obviously his former corporation has been stabilized because of that. Him and other executives have made off like bandits as a result of that. No accountability whatsoever for the crisis. They've become even wealthier as a result of it. And he says that Bernie Sanders, the one who wants to give money back to the people, that's the dangerous moment for America. You got people like Alan Greenspan, probably not surprising, the former Federal Reserve Chairman, not a big fan of Bernie Sanders. He says, remember the basic problem of inequality is the fact that people are born that way. He said that on Fox Business. I don't know what the point he's making that is. Yes, people are born into economic inequality. And thus it is on us, our political and economic system, to help to fix that. We can simply stand by and watch it, as some people do quite well because of the way the system is made, and others languish in poverty and suffering for the entirety of their lives. I guess we could do that, and I guess that's what he's supporting. I don't think that's necessarily the best path forward for American workers or for our country at large. So Alan Greenspan, I would be happy to have him oppose the damage report as well as Bernie Sanders. But those, I mean, some of these are not surprising really. But then you have groups like Third Way. So this is a centrist think tank. It's been around for a while. It wants to make sure that we put up the weakest candidates possible. Now, from their point of view, it's because those have the best chance of winning. They're dead wrong on that. They're 100% wrong, and they will never learn because they have backed any number of horrific candidates, not just for president, but representatives, and especially in the Senate, that have just gone down in flames, running weak candidacies that will never inspire anyone by attempting to say, hey, that Republican, he's kind of mean, right? Well, I'll do most of what he'll do, but I won't be mean while doing it. Vote for me. That's what they're pushing for effectively. And so no, they don't want Bernie Sanders, of course not. They say Bernie Sanders is an existential threat to the future of the Democratic Party. And what I love about that is I agree to the current state of the Democratic Party. But a better Democratic Party that will not only be more electorally successful, but also deliver for the people that the Democratic Party has said for 50 years, 100 years, even longer, that they are there for, it'll be a far better party. And so yes, it's an existential threat. Yes, in the words of Lloyd Blankfein, it's a dangerous moment, but not for America and not for the American people. It's dangerous for those who have been benefiting from the way things are. Now, some of those are benefiting economically, like this long list of billionaires. But some, like Third Way and the contractors and the consultants on all these campaigns, they've loved the way things have gone. In a perfect world, sure, they'd like political power as well, but they're certainly getting rich running these horrific campaigns that are based entirely on TV ads and bringing in consultants. And you see, I don't want to go off on too long of a tangent, but McGrath, who just launched her candidacy, raised a ton of money, and then decided to weirdly backtrack on Kavanaugh and say that Mitch McConnell, the issue with Mitch McConnell is he hasn't been effective enough in pushing Trump's agenda of draining the swamp. That's the sort of candidacy you get when you let the consultants pave the way rather than people who understand the actual desires of the American people. So I want to end with one more quote from this webpage with Bernie Sanders saying, in the words of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, they are unanimous in their hate for me and I welcome their hatred. We will overcome their greed and create an economy and a government that works for all, not just the 1%. And I love this strategy because those people, many of whom are, they go on Fox News all the time, they're well connected with these political organizations. Behind the scenes, they're attempting to tip the scales. And so why not use their opposition against them? If you are a voter and you're looking out there, there's so many candidates. Don't you want the one that all these billionaires are so opposed to, those who have done so well the way things are, those who are backing candidates who are gonna keep things the way they've been for the past few decades? I think it is a fascinating campaign strategy and I hope it works out for him. Now with that said, we are gonna take a break. We come back, some weird news to get to after this. There are already tons of comparisons on a day-to-day basis between American politics and The Handmaid's Tale. So I'm not gonna do that. I'm just gonna talk about this story and you can draw whatever conclusions you want. And it has to do with a female journalist who was attempting to do a ride along on a political candidacy who found herself running up against some particular religious-based opposition to her being there. So this is Larison Campbell of Mississippi Today who wrote, in recent weeks, in an attempt to better inform readers about candidates in the upcoming Republican gubernatorial primary, Mississippi Today has asked to shadow each contender seeking the GOP nomination. Two candidates agreed, they note. The other candidate, State Representative Robert Foster, declined, however, because I am a woman. Now, lest you believe that that's just her assuming that's why, no, it was very clear. Colton Robison, Foster's campaign director, said a male colleague would need to accompany this reporter on an upcoming 15-hour campaign trip because they believe the optics of the candidate with a woman, even a working reporter, could be used in a smear campaign to insinuate an extramarital affair. This despite my, Larison Campbell's, offering to wear a Mississippi Today press badge in plain view at all times. And so the only reason you think that people will think I'm having an improper relationship with your candidate is because I'm a woman, she says, and she's 100% right. The campaign told her they simply can't risk it. So think about that. This is not like living at his place for a few months or something. This is going on a 1 to 2 day trip, identified as a member of the press, probably surrounded by other members of the press at official events. And their argument is that because there might be trackers, these people who go along from rival campaigns and film what's going on, that they would take a photo that by its very nature, because it involves him, a man, and Larison Campbell, a woman, that would tank their candidacy. And they go back and forth with members of the campaign saying, we wouldn't have, the primary's too soon, we wouldn't have time to respond to it, it would just wreck us. Now that would be horrible if that was their actual reasoning, but I don't know that that is actually their entire reasoning. Now they're gonna continue with that for a little bit, but wait until Robert Foster himself gets involved. He talks about it in a slightly different way. So first you have that campaign director saying, perception is everything, we're so close to the primary. If trackers were to get a picture and they put a mailer out, we wouldn't have time to dispute it, and that's why we have to be careful. Now look, is it possible that campaigns are so dirty these days that they would just blatantly make up a fake affair? Yeah, that's possible. I would argue it's probably a bigger issue in Republican primaries because those are the sorts of candidacies that do that. That's a huge issue that you might wanna fight against Robert Foster when you get into office. But that's not the real reason. I mean, we know who this guy is. We know what drives his politics. I wanna give you just a brief taste and then we'll get into his response to this controversy. So he'd previously tweeted in November of last year, anyone who votes Dem in 18 is either ignorant or evil. There is no excuse for supporting killing babies or open borders. If that offends you, I'll pray for you, but I won't apologize. Switch parties and vote rep, or continue to support the destruction or our nation and vote socialist Dem. So there you have an awesome mix that really is the Republican Party in the modern era. It's this weird mix of sort of quasi-religious sentiment that's applied only to conservative principles, declaring that the entirety of the Democratic Party is socialist, even though the vast majority of those in leadership are fighting against anything even moving in that direction, and implying fake things there. He's supporting the conspiracy theory that Democrats support birthing a baby and then killing it, or making the borders entirely open. So that's who he is. He's a guy driven by fake right-wing Christian thought, willing to lie about his political opponents. Now this controversy comes up and he has to respond to it. Now remember what their argument is, that trackers will take a photo and that's reason enough. Now this is what he says, before our decision to run, my wife and I made a commitment to follow the Billy Graham rule, which is to avoid any situation that may evoke suspicion or compromise of our marriage. I am sorry Ms. Campbell doesn't share these views, but my decision was out of respect for my wife. So there, it does not seem to be about a tracker taking down their campaign. It seems to be an entirely internal thing to their marriage, where Ms. Campbell, who is so focused on her being able to have a career as a journalist, doesn't understand that this is about him and his wife, who have a relationship that is so tenuous, so fragile, that if he were to be alone for even one night with a professional woman pursuing her career, that might tumble not their campaign, but their marriage. And if her chances as a journalist have access to a campaign, an important campaign that could determine who is gonna be the governor of their state, she's run up against, I don't wanna say Gilead, but something akin to American Gilead in 2019. Now, it's not enough to make the case that he's just gonna follow the Billy Graham or the Mike Pence rule where you can never be alone with a woman because somehow that's implicitly cheating on your wife, or you guys just have a relationship that has so little trust that you would automatically assume that they were cheating if they were with someone of the opposite sex. He then goes on the offensive saying, once again, the liberal left is attacking someone for their integrity, professionalism, and Christian beliefs. They aren't just attacking me, they're attacking the countless Mississippians who also share these values, blah, 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 blah. I'm going to make the case, now I'm not from Mississippi, I'm not sure I've ever been there. I don't think the majority of Mississippians believe that if you're married, you're not allowed to be alone with someone of the opposite sex. I think that is a slur against good thinking Mississippians who are stronger than that emotionally and psychologically in their relationships. And look at that, he says the liberal left is attacking someone for their integrity, professionalism, and Christian beliefs. This is not a Christian belief. Now, it's a belief that some Christians have, but it's not like Jesus was, the Sermon on the Mount was about, hey, everybody, don't stand too close. Hey, you're next to a woman, back up, get back. That's not what he was really talking about. Integrity, professionalism. She has integrity, she has professionalism. As a professional journalist, you don't care about that. You don't care about that at all. Your religious beliefs are not just about you and your relationship. They're not rights that you should have. They're about things that you should exercise on other people, literally banning them from covering your candidacy if they have committed the sin of having a vagina. That's what it is. There's no integrity there. You're literally the only person in this story without any integrity. And yet, of course, he's going to go on the attack. And he continues, as I anticipated, the liberal left lost their minds over the fact I chose not to be alone with another woman. They can't believe that even in 2019, someone still values their relationship with their wife and upholds their Christian faith. Look, he's married. So technically, he's got more relationship cred than I do. But I'm engaged now. And if I thought the only way that I could value my fiance was to literally never be alone with a woman, that's trouble. That's trouble for my marriage. That's trouble for me. That's trouble for my mental state. Right now, Edwin, thank you for being a man. Because if you were a woman right now, I would be disrespecting my fiance. There are some women in the control room right now. Skip, get between me and them. I want to show respect to my wife. Now, fiance, I understand that some people are going to find this to be offensive, everything that I'm saying, that I'm not being compassionate enough. But the thing is, again, we're not talking about something that is about you or your relationship. That's what they want to pitch it as. But when you're banning people from doing their job, when you're literally blocking people from knowing what's going on in your political candidacy, not in your attempt to become a pastor, but your attempt to become the governor of a state, that has nothing to do with your religion. It has nothing to do with your relationship. It has everything to do with you thinking that democracy and media access is contingent on whatever you want it to be in that particular moment. And it's not. That's not what American democracy is about. We are not a religious state, and our media access is not dependent on you thinking that it fits in with whatever particular sect of religion you happen to be a part of. If you want to practice that in your own relationship, you can do that. I'm worried for you, but you can do that. That's your right as an American. But when you start saying that Larison Campbell can't do her job, then I have to do my job, which is attack you and probably try to stop you from getting a new job as the governor of Mississippi. I could say more. There were some great responses on Twitter. I'm not going to go through them, especially because there's some swears and I don't want them to slip through. But anyway, lots more to get to. On the other side, Megan Rapinoe, she's a new target of Ben Shapiro, who is even more screechy and annoying than usual after this.
You're saying capitalism can actually increase your pay. That's never going to be a thing that anyone on the left asks. Instead, we all have to pretend that this is all normal and that it's not divisive at all and that truly she's a hero to everyone.
There you have conservative pundit and animated Funko Pop figure Ben Shapiro on Megan Rapinoe, who apparently, like, she has helped to push, and the rest of the team too, has helped to push a new conversation about pay equity in sports, which he is viscerally, physically opposed to for reasons that will change depending on whatever's on his mind at a particular moment. What he knows is that he doesn't want it to happen. So we have made the case that economically it makes sense for them to be paid more. Sure. He doesn't accept that, of course.
No.
And we're gonna have more. He gets into some really homophobic territory against them as well. But you've been following Ben Shapiro, the story of the team as well, but Ben Shapiro's too. What are your thoughts?
I see you've got a lot of notes. Rick Strom, by the way. Thank you for that great intro.
Oh, I didn't actually introduce you. Everybody knows who you are on this channel.
So anyways.
TDR sports correspondent, Rick Strom.
Paid handsomely for it. Sports. Yeah, yes. How you doing, Jonathan? Sorry, what's your question about Shapiro? I mean, where do we even start?
I mean, this is your bailiwick. Tell us about it.
Right, I don't even know how to spell that. but like, here's my thing with Ben Shapiro. So he goes into this talking point, which is the total fundamental way to make it as a right-wing pundit, which is be grateful that you're even given the platform through your own sporting, as he likes to put it, as he ends this.
We're going to have that in the first video, actually.
Sorry. Should we just play it now?
Let's just do it.
Screw this guy.
I love it. Okay, so here's some more of Ben Shapiro. All
right. Absolute silliness. Absolute silliness, and bad for the country, by the way. When even the stuff that we take a break with, you know, sporting, is turned into this, it's pretty obnoxious. And we're not talking about 1968 in the middle of the civil rights movement with US sprinters on the US national team at the Olympics raising the black power fist because American politics are polarized around race in 68. We're not talking about that. We're talking about Gay marriage is legal across the United States by Supreme Court diktat. We are talking about Megan Rapinoe is getting million-dollar contracts specifically because of her sexuality and because she is a very, very good soccer player. But let's not make any mistake. If she were a very good soccer player and she were not a very outspoken lesbian, she would be getting fewer contracts.
That's something
so bad.
So don't you enjoy, you know, after a long week of working, don't you enjoy sporting for a bit?
Oh, man, I love sporting.
Which do the American people say less, sporting or diktat?
Diktat.
Probably that. Yeah.
You shouldn't bring up sporting, by the way. You know who uses that? The BBC, which absolutely owns him every time
that's
he goes
true.
On there.
That did happen. So yes. I like that he at least admitted that she's being paid so well because she's a lesbian.
Right.
Also because she's arguably one of the best soccer players in the world.
Right.
I guess that's a throwaway line, right. But okay.
So like she didn't win two NWSL Shields, which is viewed as the best women's soccer league anywhere, anywhere. Like she didn't win a club title in Olympic Lyonnais with the club where she actually won the World Cup as well in France. She didn't win the Golden Boot. She didn't win the Golden Ball. She wasn't one of the best, the best players at this year's tournament. She's 33 years old. She is an anomaly. She's an icon. She's a legend. I don't know where you want to fit diktat in there, but I would say that everything that she has done is exactly what Ben Shapiro is fighting for. And actually, I pulled up something because in my opinion, this is like the grand slam for conservative pundits like Ben Shapiro, is that it's a woman, is that she's gay, and she doesn't respect the flag or the anthem or the president. Like, I mean, you are talking a smorgasbord of, yes, give me the fuel, from a right-wing standpoint. The homosexual assault on traditional marriage by Ben Shapiro. Their point, sorry, I'm not trying to cut off my face. Their point in Washington, as in liberals, is purportedly to prove that traditional marriage is not solely about children and that it is not about children. It is about discrimination for its own sake. Thank you so much. But even same-sex marriage advocates realize that through traditional marriage sees children as the first priority. It does not rest its legitimacy solely on the basis of childbearing and rearing. This guy's an idiot. Here's another thing. Come back to me for 1 second, guys. I'm actually wearing a Hamza, okay? I'm a Jewish person, but I also recognize the oppression of women with his very religion of being an Orthodox Jew. So from one Jew to another, let's just be real about this. What he supports, let's throw him back on for a second. Women must sit, because this is his shtick. Women must sit at the back of the bus, says ultra-Orthodox men, some of whom have screamed at, kicked, and beaten women who refuse to move from the front. Ultra-Orthodox leaders have actually prevailed upon the Egg Bus Company, Israel's main line, to run some segregated buses through different territories in Israel. You can come back to us. Yeah. So like, this is what he stands for. So the fact that it's someone who is pretty much, aside from their skin color, the total opposite of what he is, it is a grand slam for him.
Exactly. If she converts to Islam,
Oh man. Now we're talking.
But wait, he opposed gay marriage? I mean, he just said they should be satisfied because we live in a country
they
where
should.
It's so good to be gay because we legalize it. So he actually fought against that. He still opposes it.
Yes.
So this is, once again, you can add this to Tucker Carlson and Ilhan Omar. You can add this to Mitch McConnell on reparations. As always, the former work, the historic work of good non-conservatives will always be used by conservatives to argue for why no more work needs to be done.
Amen to that, brother. Another very, very quick point. She's really good at soccer.
She is.
She's really good. So being cut from the same cloth Shapiro is of the Tucker Carlson's, Laura Ingram, shut up and dribbles. By the way, and I did this today very quickly, and then we're going to wrap, is that they made their own bed with this and also dug their own grave for the shut up and dribble movement. It's their fault.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm wearing.
She didn't have to say that.
I'm wearing a LeBron James I Promise School rubber band, doing some work with Uninterrupted, his incredible, incredible company. Blame yourselves for this.
Yeah.
Blame all of you and your own line of thinking, because you tried to marginalize people, okay? You tried to marginalize them by being like, no, you're only good as a contract. You're only as good as how you dribble a basketball or kick a football or whatever. Those days are long, long gone. Thanks to you guys.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, stay in your lane. If you're an athlete, don't get involved in politics.
Why
politics is for the reality TV stars, the professionals, okay? Yeah, Yeah, and I'll just mention this again, just because we don't have to talk about Ben Shapiro, but I will here. He is a guy who has attempted to accrue a reputation as being founded in logic and reason. He's the logic guy. Mm. And yet there he is ranting based entirely on religious dogma that he was propagandized into as a kid that he, as an adult, can't see past, can't overcome. His hatred for women, his hatred for the LGBTQ community, that's what defines his commentary. Thank Amen. You so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
It's good to have you here.
Thank you. I look forward to more sporting.
You will. See you tomorrow, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.